What's up, everyone, and welcome to the fifth episode of Shooting the Breeze. I'm your host, Max Hooper, and the purpose of this podcast is for me to share my unique basketball experiences and perspectives while also sharing those of my guests. For those of you who aren't aware, my entire senior season at Oakland University, I did not attempt one two-point field goal, and I took a whole lot of threes, 257 of them, as a matter of fact. I've always prided myself in being a great shooter, and that is what continues to propel my basketball career. So, yep, you guessed it. On this show, we'll be talking shooting. Today, I have a very special guest, George Niang. I first crossed paths with George in prep school in 2011. I was playing at Brewster Academy, and he was playing at the Tilton School. We had some very heated games against one another. I considered attending Iowa State when I was transferring, so I spoke a little bit with George then, but I didn't spend a great deal of time around him until last spring and summer. George and I are represented by different agents, but under the same firm, Wasserman. During the time prior to the 2016 NBA draft, me, George, and a few other players spent a few months together in LA training to prepare for workouts with NBA teams. I have a great deal of respect for what he was able to accomplish at Iowa State and for the work he has put into his game over the years to allow himself to grow as a player. Today we'll talk about his time at Iowa State, playing for Coach Fred Hoiberg, the experience of playing in the NEPSAC, the transition from college to the NBA, as well as his favorite places to play in college. Without any further ado, what's up, George? Great to have you on the show.
Well, what's going on? How you doing?
Doing well. You know, it's been a little bit of a challenge to pin you down here. You know, busy NBA schedule, but glad to get you on the show. You know, no need to beat around the bush. Let's just dive right into it. Let's get to it. You know, People might be somewhat familiar, you know, with your career at this point, you know, who are listening. But for people who aren't, overly familiar with what your journey's been like, just talk about, starting with high school, you know, through your journey. Talk about what it's been like, you know, just going through that and having to make a name for yourself, coming from a guy who wasn't, you know, widely recognized early in high school.
Yeah. I come from a small town in Massachusetts called Methuen, you know, and I've never really, you know, had anybody to look up to, whether it being an NBA player from my neighboring town or area. So, you know, I really had to create a little motivation by myself. And, you know, when people ask, you know, did you ever see this happening? You know, I can't really say that I did. You know, obviously to play in the NBA was a dream, but I always took it step by step. I always remember, you know, I wanted to get a college scholarship, or, you know, I wanted to play for a good high school team. And then from there, I wanted to play for, you know, a good university. And then from there, you know, then you just slowly start to realize, you know, bigger dreams can become a reality. So I think the biggest thing is you can't look too far ahead. You just have to take it one day at a time and really focus on yourself and try to get a little better each day. But that being said, you know, my journey was pretty special. You know, I was lucky enough to have a family that, you know, wanted to send me to prep school, you know, for academics. And from there on, you know, we ended up having a pretty good basketball team where I, you know, got a chance to play with some great players there. And from there, I went on to Iowa State, where I got to play for, you know, probably one of the better college coaches at the time, who coaches for the Chicago Bulls right now, Fred Hoiberg. You know, he really gave me the opportunity to succeed and gave me the reins of the team at a young age, you know, in college, and I'm super thankful for that. And, you know, now I'm blessed to be playing for an organization, the Indiana Pacers, where, you know, they not only care for us as basketball players, but as human beings. And, you know, I'm having a blast. It's a ton of fun learning, you know, the schemes day in and day out, the grind, and how to always be ready to get out there and play at the highest level. Because, as you know, in the NBA, you have to bring it every night. You know, it's a long season, and, everybody's out there trying to beat you.
Absolutely. All great stuff right there, you know. Just a little overview, just to get people somewhat familiar with it. So, I first came, you know, met you, I think it would have been your junior year, I believe, you know. So yep. Along that path of development, you know, but your game is completely different from then to what it is now. You've transformed your body, you worked to put so much into it to get to where you are, and you're just, I believe you're just scratching the surface, you know, and I think you would agree. But talk about what it, you know, being, you know, a guy, you know, not necessarily a high flyer and, you know, free, you know, gifted with a 45-inch vertical or whatever, talk about what your player development was. You know, describe your game early in your career and how you, what the steps you took to, you know, to take your game to the next level.
You know, I think early in my career, you know, I was always, I say blessed with a bigger body.
I like it.
I always tried to, you know, work on my low post game and really just try to, you know, be able to use both hands in the post. And then from there on out, you know, I started to develop a jump shot. And then, you know, you just, every summer, you just slowly start adding things, start, you know, being able to ball handle. And then, you know, really just try to do everything out there. And, you know, it's been lucky for me that the game of basketball is going in the way where, you know, you need more skill guys on the court to make plays. And, you know, now I'm just consistently just, you know, working on becoming more versatile, whether that's guarding threes, guarding fours. You know, you just want to – the more versatile you are, the more you can be out on the court. And I think that really helps. But I can't say it's all on me. I've been lucky enough to work with, you know, great development coaches, whether, you know, if it was Noah LaRoche, Marcus O'Neill up at Tilton School, or, you know, one of my mentors, Rick Gorman. You know, I've been blessed enough to work with people where they tell me the truth and not just tell me what I want to hear. And I think that's the biggest misconception nowadays, is that kids are working with people that tell them what they want to hear. And then when someone tells them what they don't want to hear, they think they're picking on them. So, you know, I think it's a tough world that we live in, but you know, you don't want to be around people that are just going to tell you what you want to hear. You got to be around people that are going to challenge you day in and day out.
Totally, totally. And I like what you said about people who, you know, you've been, you know, obviously you had to put in the work yourself, but you've had great people, you know, help you along the way. And everyone has people help them along the way. I think also, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, like you said, having a bigger body and, you know, that kind of, you know, When you're a young player, you know, you don't really know what your position is. You know, they just kind of throw you in the post if you're taller than people, bigger than people. But right now, I think, you know, now that you have expanded your game, developed all those perimeter skills, having that post foundation, you know, you have all those skills on the block, you know, to complement, you know, the ball handling and the perimeter. So you're a completely versatile player inside and out. And, you know, a lot of people say that, but, you know, there's very few players who truly have that complete package. And I think you were also fortunate to be in a great situation, you know, in Iowa State, where you were allowed to do lots of different things. Because in some situations, college coaches, you know, put constraints on players and, you know, tell them, I want you to only play in the post, or, you know, you're not going to do this, you're not going to do that. But, I mean, based on what I was looking at, it looked like you had quite a bit of freedom. And do you think that played into your development as well?
Oh, yeah. You know, I was given so much freedom, almost to the point where, you know, I could try different things out and fail and see how they didn't work. You know, I think experience trumps all types of development. You know, when you can get out there and experience things on the court, you know what you can get away with and what you can't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was given that freedom that not too many people have. And that's another thing that I think, you know, with college basketball and high school recruits, is that these guys want to go to these big names where they have guys at their positions rather than going somewhere where there's opportunity. And I think that's the one thing that I looked at. Iowa State wasn't the best when I committed there, but they had opportunity for me to play, and that's what really was important to me. And I wanted to get out there and prove that to everybody. And, you know, I just think the biggest thing is coming from high school to college is don't feel like you've made it, you know. Mm-hmm. Continue to work hard, because there's so much more out there. This game can take you to so many different places, and I think people just need to be eager to learn and listen and become better players. So if they can do that, then, you know, the sky's the limit for anybody.
Yes, absolutely. Damn it, you stole my question, actually. My my question about I wanted to get into it with you. Let's talk about, you know, how, like you said, kids get enamored by, you know, the big name, and it, I think, you know, when, you know, social media, when you and I were getting recruited, you know, whatever it was, 4 or 5 years ago, you know, was big. But I think nowadays, you know, you see kids tweeting about this scholarship offer and these are my top 10 schools. You know, it's almost bragging, yeah, rights. You know, it's scary, because what's really important here? You know, is it a school that's going to fit you best and fit your skill set and have a coach that believes in you? Or is it just, oh, let me go to the biggest name and, you know, let me get as many social media likes as I can? You know, it's kind of frightening. And sometimes, like you said, you get it. You know, when a school, you know, the big name schools come calling, and, you know, it's it's exciting. You know, that's what you dream of. But you really have to consider who is you know, the best fit, who's going to promote growth in your game. And I think sometimes, you know, it happens when a kid waits around till the, you know, the spring of their senior year, and these teams have gone through, you know, their first, second, third option, they're all gone. Oh, let's go to our fourth option and try to recruit him, and then end up not having a great experience. What do you think about that?
You know, I just think that goes back to being around people that can tell you the truth and tell you, you know, not what you want to hear, but, you know, what it really is. And if you have those people around you, I don't think they'll steer you wrong and let you make those type of decisions. But like I said, that's the problem nowadays, is that people are too busy, caught up hanging around people that tell them what they want to hear rather than what the truth actually is. And that's sad, because, you know, it ruins kids' careers. I mean, you know better than anybody, you know, transferring and having to sit out is not a pleasant experience, you know? It's definitely, I don't want to say it's a career killer, but it just makes the odds even tougher against you. So, you know, you really want to go to a place where you have opportunity to just be you, you know? I mean, I feel like so many people get to places and try to skew from what got them there. Don't forget what made you the player you were, and stick to those and constantly try to improve. If you do that, you know, the sky's the limit and you'll be all right. But other than that, you know, I just think too many people get caught up in the UNC, the UCLAs, and, you know, focus on a place where you can go there, be you, and help your team win.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying, you know, go to a school that's at the bottom of your division, but if that fits you, then, you know, I mean, that's where you should really think about going.
Right. And now, like you said Iowa State was a whole different story when you first stepped on campus compared to the reputation that it has now. You know what I mean? It definitely was not, you know, the upper echelon of the Big 12 like it is. And I think you, and along with, you know, the recruits, you know, in the classes before and after you, were a huge part of turning it into that. But, like, people will, you know, people might listen to this and be like, oh, well, he went to Iowa State, what's he talking about? But Iowa State, you know, prior to that, had not gotten it rolling and was, you know, towards the bottom of the conference. So, sure, you could have, you know, probably gone to other schools, other places that might have had a better reputation, but Iowa State presented the best opportunity.
Yeah, when I committed to Iowa State, they were 16-16. They had lost in the first round of the Big 12 tournament, and they had missed the NCAA tournament for, like, the eighth year in a row.
Right.
And, you know, when I committed there, you know, what I really was sold on is that, you know, the coach wanted me as – I was his first option. I was his plan A. He didn't want to have a plan B or C. And, you know, he really wanted to build around me. And, you know, when someone tells you that and gives you the opportunity like that, it's really how – now the program is in your hands. You know, how successful are you going to make them? And, you know, I felt with how hard I worked, if I could convince a couple other guys, along with, like, Naz Long, Monte Morris, you know, convince other guys to come there, that, you know, we could really turn that program around. And, you know, obviously by the grace of God and, you know, obviously some luck, things went our way, and we had a hell of a coaching staff. We got games rolling. We ran off games. We beat teams that we were predicted not to beat. And, you know, make things happen. I just think you got to find ways to make things happen and just continue to get better day in and day out. That's really all you can do, and the rest will take care of itself.
Right. No, I like that. And I think, honestly, frankly, I think I got caught up in, you know, a little bit of the chance to be able to play in the Big East and go to St. John's, and with making that decision, whereas, you know, a place that's not quite as glamorous, you know, like at Oakland, I think I would have had a better experience had I been there all 4 years. Not, you know, I don't regret anything. You know, it is what it is. But just I know that ultimately Oakland is where I'm so thankful that I ended up, you know, just from my own experience. And if you're good enough ultimately to go to the NBA, I mean, the cream will rise to the top. You know, you got guys like yourself. You guys got guys like Kay Felder, you know, who I mean, he's 5'9" and he's at Oakland University. Who would have ever thought? But you know, it's like you said, getting better every day and believing, and, you know, just not letting people determine what you're worth, but showing your game and letting it all speak for itself, basically.
So
we talked about this a little bit, but we touched on your high school experience, but let's go in depth in your playing in the NEPSAC and what it's like, you know, playing against, you know, top ranked players, and you know, you've got guys in the NBA like Isaiah Thomas, Deion Waiters, Mo Harkless, Shakar Sampson, TJ Warren, Noah Vonleh, Andre Drummond, Samaje Christian, the list goes on and on. For those who maybe aren't as familiar with, you know, the prep school basketball scene, or like, talk about the, you know, how that impacted you compared to just playing at, you know, just your regular old public high school where the competition isn't
as high. The best thing was is in the NEPSAC, you were playing, you know, four or five guys, maybe even 10 guys that, you know, were going to be playing at high level, major college basketball, BCS schools. Mm-hmm. And so if you got to play every night against teams that are, you know, constantly, you know, winning against other teams in NEPSAC and constantly putting guys into high level programs and then into the NBA, like, you know, you're going to get better. And, you know, not only if you had guys on your team that were, you know, speaking for you, I mean, you played on a team where there were, what was there, four NBA players on that team now?
The team after me, my team had two.
Oh, okay, yeah. But even, you know, playing with NBA players at a public high school, you know, you're rarely going to have two on the same team.
Right, extremely rarely.
Yeah, in the NEPSAC, you're having sometimes three or four on one team, and you're having to go against them or even play against guys in practice. Mm-hmm. And I just think overall, you play the more you play, the better you're going to get. And the better competition you play, the better you're going to get at a faster rate. Mm-hmm. And I just think the NEPSAC was much longer than the regular high school season. You played more teams. It was based more on college. You lived away at school. You traveled all over New England, sometimes mm-hmm. the country. Mm-hmm. And you really had to figure out how to do your work on your own without your parents being there, live in a dorm, wake up to go to class on time. It was really like college, you know, 4 years before you had to go to, you know, college. So by the time I got to college, it was all second nature to me. I really all I had to focus on was basketball because the schoolwork and study habits, I had already had that stuff down. But the basketball, you know, if you play against the team that we were playing against, like you named off guys. I remember we played, a Brewster team that had Mitch McGarry, Jakar Sampson, TJ Warren, mm-hmm. Samaj Christian, Nadir Tharp, who went to Kansas. Yeah, you know, Thomas Robinson, Andrew Fitzgerald, all those guys are guys that played at high levels. And then you have other guys that come off the bench who are Division I players. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes we'd have guys that were Division I players coming off Division III players. So, right. You know, you just had to find ways to, you know, make it work and challenge yourself. And if you've been challenged for so many years before that, you know, college, just you seem like you can just hop in there and fit right in.
Right. I think that's huge. You know, people who aren't – well, I think sometimes – because I'm from California, so I got a different perspective. You're from Massachusetts, so everyone goes to boarding school in Massachusetts. You know what I mean? It's not everyone, but people are very familiar with it. You know, when you're on the West Coast, it's like, oh, you're going to boarding school. You know, people think it's like, you know, you're going to like reform school or like you got in trouble or something like that. But that's not the case at all. You know what I mean? You're just, or people get the, you know, some of these schools give a bad impression. You know, they're like diploma mills where the kids aren't really in class, but it's like, you know, a school like Brewster or Tilton, like those have been schools for like literally hundreds of years. And like, you know, you got to go to class or they hold you accountable. You know, you're living in the dorm, you're going to the cafeteria and all sorts of things. So it's like a mini college experience almost, you know, whereas, you know, the stakes aren't as high, you know, in college, if your coach doesn't win, he's getting fired. So he's on you and he's trying to make it happen. But I mean, the expectations are high at Brewster. You know, if you lose probably two or three games a year, you know, it's a disappointing season. And so it's just like, I just think if anyone is a top ranked player, they're really doing themselves a disservice by not, you know, going the prep school route. I think it just prepares you in so many different ways.
Yeah, such a great experience. You meet a ton of people that, you know, you'll probably be friends with for the rest of your life. I still talk to a ton of people from my high school and, you know, still have a great relationship with them. And it's great to see where they've gone. You know, prep mm-hmm. schools produce a lot of great kids. Not saying that other places don't, but, you know, I feel like the mold that they make you is is great at prep schools.
Totally, totally. So let's shift gears just a tiny bit. You know, this is, I call the podcast Shooting the Breeze. You know what I mean? Shooting, that's what I do. I'm a shooter. So talk to me. You know, you are a guy who's definitely expanded his game. You know, end up shooting, I can't remember the stats off the top of my head, almost 40 from the three, or maybe over 40 from the three a couple of years, whatever it was. But, I mean, you know, shooting's not your one thing you do. You have lots of skills on the court, but you definitely have developed as a shooter. So if you're either, you could, you know, if you're looking at a shooter, or if you're maybe teaching a young player to shoot, something like that, talk about three major keys in shooting. Like, what do you think the three most important things are in shooting?
I think the biggest thing is you got to have great balance and focus. You know, I think too many kids are caught with, you know, shooting off balance shots at a young age. I'm not saying as you get older you're going to have to learn how to shoot off balance, but I just think when you're building your foundation, you want to start with having a good balance and always focus on shooting the ball the same way every time. You know, if you really want to get specific, always having your elbow in, you know, and always following through. But some guys, you know, have different forms, you know, since I've seen being in the NBA that guys shoot the ball differently, but the ball just seems to go in.
Right.
But, you know, I think when you break it down, I think you want to have great balance, shoot the ball every time, and, you know, really try to hold your follow through and really have great arc and, you know, backspin on the ball, I think, on rotation. I just think the biggest thing that's a lost art now is, you know, people are, you know, having bad mechanics, and that's why you see guys that, you know, don't work as hard as other guys have inconsistent shots.
I like that. I like that. And also one thing I want to ask you about, talk about the mental aspect of shooting, though. How important, you know, the mentality of, you know, the confidence and the shooter's mentality. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, it's no surprise that you're one of the better shooters to play the game. You know, and I mean that in all seriousness, just because after being around you, you have the confidence that you actually believe that you're the best shooter in the world. And I think that goes a long way with shooting. I mean, you know, you have to be confident in what you do. So, if you feel like you're the best shooter, then shoot it like you're the best shooter. And I think that all goes hand in hand. If you feel like you're the best, then the results are going to show. I think when a shooter, doesn't trust himself or starts to become inconsistent, that's when your shot becomes inconsistent. You really have to believe in the work you put in and everything that you've done, and I think the rest will take care of itself. I mean, you're the picture child for that. I mean,
Not yet.
Easy to go to three different schools and, you know, just continue to do the same thing and not try to wonder, oh, should I not be a shooter? Should I be this? You know, you stick to who you are and believe, and it's impressive.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. I think, like you said, you know, you feel like I believe I'm the best shooter or whatever, but it also, I think there's the marriage of, you know, the confidence and the work, because I think the work is what propels my confidence. You know what I mean? I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I've shot hundreds and thousands of shots. So why shouldn't I be the one to be able to shoot it? You know what I mean? That's really my mindset. And I think also something to add on is, you know, every great shooter is a gym rat. You know what I mean? I've never met a guy who's a truly, you know, elite great shooter who doesn't love, you know, putting up his shots and who isn't like obsessive with it. You know, they're all very meticulous. You never really meet a shooter who has, you know, is sloppy or, you know, doesn't have a high attention to detail, because, you know, as a shooter, I think, you know, even if I'm making them, you know, but maybe they're hitting the rim, I'm like, I start getting pissed off. You know what I mean? I'm like, I want to swish. You know what I mean? And I think I saw you starting to develop that. You know what I mean? Because, when we were working out, you know, we'd always be going head to head and whatnot, and we'd always be going crazy. And, you know, it'd always be like, gotta have a swish, you know, that type of thing. And that, like you said, focus, confidence, all those sorts of things, it all goes into it. And it's just, you know, I'm very fascinated at all the shooters I've ever been around have that, like, you know, super focused and are like obsessive over, you know, getting their shots up and making sure they're, their mechanics are just right. And also something you talked about was how everyone has a little different form. I think everyone just has, you know, everyone has a different handwriting. Everyone has a different signature. You know, it's a little bit different, but we're all writing the same language.
Right.
Like you said, as long as it goes in, there's some fundamentals that most pretty much all shooters have. But then you got Reggie Miller. You know what I mean? I don't even know how to describe Reggie Miller's shot. I don't know what the hell that is. But
yeah,
the guy could get open and let it fly. So, you know, that was that was a special thing. As long as the ball's going in at the end of the, you could kick it in. you could headbutt it in. If it's going in, they don't care. But there's some certain fundamentals. But so let's talk about a little bit. So we talked about the shooting and the mentality and all sorts of things like that. What kind of impact do you think a shooter has on the court? And if from your experience, you know, as a player who probably commands, you know, double teams and extra defensive attention, how much does a shooter help you?
When I was demanding double teams.
that was more back to college age.
That's just an outlet. You know, you don't even think twice when a double team's coming and you see that guy open, because you know he's going to make him pay when you pass the ball. Because three's worth more than two. I mean, I hate to break it to people. I mean, if you just have someone that can consistently knock down a shot from the outside, that really is a thorn in the side of the defense, because now that gives you space and time to operate. Because how many times are they going to keep coming and double teaming you if you can consistently find shooters that are constantly going to make shots for you? I mean, that just makes a defense have to make a decision. Pick your poison. Which one are you going to stick with? You know, which one are you going to live and die with? So I think shooters are so important to space the floor, because you can't really have offense if there's no space on the floor. So I think shooting is something that you need on the floor. And if I ever were to coach, I'd love to have every player be able to shoot it. I think that's something in the game that you need to have, and the young guys need to start developing.
Right. And I think the game is transitioning there slowly but surely. But you know, as a shooter, from my, you know, based on my experience, you know, as when you come out on the court, you're marked. You know what I mean? Everyone's yelling out shooter, shooter, shooter. You know, the scouting report is, you know, can't let him get a shot off. And I welcome that. I love that, because I love, you know, running off pin downs and running, you know, keep, you know, that Reggie Miller type, Rip Hamilton type of movement, where it just distracts the defense and it gets other shots, you know, it gets open shots for other people. It's actually funny. A good friend of both of ours, Sharon Dorsey Walker, he was on my show, and I never heard of someone suggest this, but he said, I wish the shooter could get an assist without even touching the ball. Like when he, you know, when you run that move, that pin down, and then you get the slip wide open and the big man gets the ball. He said, I wish the shooter could get that assist.
Yeah.
And I just think that's true. I like that. You know, obviously he's kind of joking around, but I like the idea that, you know, I like the idea as a shooter being able to create for people without even touching the ball. You know, just the threat of my shot making the defense shift a little bit, so then it creates a, you know, better passing angle or all sorts of things like that. And you've probably dealt with that, you know, now being at this level, having to defend guys, like, not necessarily you're chasing them around, but, you know, on the scouting report, Kyle Korver, J.J. Redick, you know, guys like that who just compromise the defense in certain ways, don't you think?
Yeah, you know, I think the worst thing is when you're chasing a guy around for, you know, a couple pin downs and you actually get a good contest and it still goes in. those are the daggers that, you know, you don't want to live with. That's discouraging for a defense. It's like, should I retain this energy to defend him the next time? Because right, maybe the next time I could block his shot, but then when they do it again and consistently, it's just frustrating. If you can run someone off a bunch of screens and make shots, I mean, it's just a thorn in the defense side. Like I said, nobody enjoys getting hit by screens or chasing after someone. That's not pleasant. But, I mean, you want to stop the other team, and if the other team keeps knocking down shots, you know, they're going to have to change their schemes, and, you know, that plays into your hands when the other team is playing into your strengths.
Totally. And I mean, you probably experienced that also in college, you know, having guys on your team who you could, you know, run off all sorts of things, like Naz Long and Matt Thomas, you know, guys who the defense have to pay extra attention to. And sometimes those three-pointers are daggers, you know, when it's a crucial possession, and those are back-breaking shots. And you probably see that, you know, the the opposing coach, maybe assistant coach, slams his clipboard or something like that. It's just, I just love the fact that shooters can like change the game in that way. So let's talk about a little bit your like roles on the team, and how important do you think it is to have people understand their jobs and, you know what their role is, so they can grow in that role and do, you know, help the team in the best of the, in the best way that they can.
You know, I think it's huge, especially with defining roles. You know, not everybody can be the scorer. Not everybody can be, you know, the guy. So, you know, you need to have a team where guys are bought in to being that defensive guy, being that mm-hmm. guy who comes in and has energy off the bench, or being that shooter. You know, every team needs someone with an identity that helps them build their identity as a team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the higher level you get, the harder it is to be the guy. So you want to be able to do a couple things great that, you know, help your team win. And, you know, that all starts on the defensive end. So, you know, I think if you can start off being a good defender, that helps. But then again, you know, we're shooting the breeze here. The game can always use shooters. If you can shoot the ball, there's always a spot for you, no matter where you are. You shooting is just so lethal and dangerous that, you know, it's key to have one on your team. So if you can master that skill, you're going to have a long career.
Right. I think at any level, you know, it's important to for people to understand their roles, because if you don't, you know, maybe you'll run into issues of, you know, maybe jealousy of like, why is this guy taking these shots? Or, you know, you'll run into, you know, maybe guys not taking the right types of shots. Because a team that really understands their roles is the team that's pretty much going to take good shots, because they're going to understand there's certain guys that take certain types of shots, and then there's certain guys who do other things, you know. And I think that's what makes it, you know, a great team is if you can mesh all those people excelling in their roles. I think it's I mean, that's really what makes the great teams great. And yeah, so let's shift gears again just a tiny bit. And you know, in college, you were this, you know, you were arguably one of the best players in school history. You know, had a huge role. Did, you know, pretty much had the offense designed around you, and you were a leader and all sorts of things. So now you're back to the bottom of the totem pole. You know, you're a guy who doesn't know when his number's going to get called, and you just got to stay ready at all times. Talk about that transition from being, you know, the guy, you know, one, or if not the guy, you know, one of the major guys, you know, one of the leading scorers, and to being, you know, in the position you are now, where you have to, you know, press the reset button and build your way back up. Talk about that transition.
Yeah, I just think you need to find a consistent routine, mm-hmm. you know, where that's coming in and getting your shots in every day, and treating it like like you're going to get in the game every day, because you never know. Mm-hmm. You never know when they're going to call your number and throw you in there, and you need to be ready. So I think the biggest thing with me is I try to find a consistent routine that I like, and, you know, every day, and just constantly stay true to that, get my shots up, and stay in shape. I think that's the biggest thing, is you need to, you know, constantly be in the weight room, lift weights, get your conditioning in, and still get your reps on the court, because, you know, even if you're not playing, you're not getting those reps. So you need to be ready and sharp and be ready to be effective when you get in the game. But the biggest advice I could give is just have a routine, whether if that's you take naps on game days. Don't ever break that routine, because you know, you want to be consistent in everything that you do, and when you want to be consistent when you get out on the court.
Yeah, totally. I think a guy, you know, when you're playing heavy minutes in college, you know, conditioning in season might not be as much of a, you know, consideration, because if you're playing 36, 37 minutes every night, basically, you know, I mean, that's pretty damn good conditioning right there.
Yeah. But, yeah, you know, exactly.
But, you know, if you're back to square one, and just like every rookie is, you know, even if you're the number one pick, you're still, you know, back on the bottom of the totem pole, and, you know, you're still trying to find your way. And obviously in college, you know, you had a level of comfortability where you knew the system, you knew every, you know, not that you knew everything, you weren't still learning, but you know what I mean, you were comfortable in the system. And here you're in a whole new city, new life, new world, and just trying to find your way. And so I just think it's, you know, it's interesting that most college, all college players have to go through that, because there's pretty much everyone who's in the NBA was the man or one of the men on their team, and now they're going through that. And I like what you said about staying in shape and got to stay ready, because in the NBA, it's next man up. You never know.
Exactly.
You never know if a guy gets injured, a guy gets fouls out, whatever. You never know. And like you said, it right now, you know, it's your job. You got to be ready to perform. So I like the
analogy.
Yeah, I like it. I like the analogy. So how about talking about the NBA? Do you think, talk about what it was like to play for Fred Hoiberg? You know, do you think that gave you any leg up, him having NBA experience, or any, you know, any thoughts on Fred Hoiberg? I know it must have been a tremendous experience.
Oh, no, it was great playing for Fred Hoiberg. I couldn't ask for a better experience. That being said, you know, he really helped me a lot with understanding some of the NBA schemes and how things work around here. But, you know, there's no simulation for the NBA game until you get here.
Of course.
What I really learned. This is just a whole different ball game, whether it's the rotations. There's a rhyme or reason for doing everything around here. And, you know, obviously he helped me a ton with being more familiar with some of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a little while to catch up to speed and learn how things go while you're out on the court and where you need to be and what you need to do and how to defend certain things. So, you know, he definitely helped me a ton, especially, you know, on the offensive end of, you know, play calling and picking at mismatches and what you're looking for and spacing. And, you know, I couldn't be thankful more for having a mentor, friend, and a coach like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Fred Hoiberg, I've only seen it from the outside, but I dealt with him a tiny bit in recruiting, you know, slightly considered attending Iowa State, you know, it didn't quite materialize. But I mean, frankly, Fred Hoiberg is a guy, played, you know, had a great college career, played 10 years in the NBA, and then was in the front office, and now a college head coach. Frankly, that's my dream career path. That was a guy who I, you know, really looked at, and he's obviously, I can't speak from specifics, but seems to be a great basketball mind, and also, you know, a great leader in the sense that he's not necessarily a guy who's going to cuss you out all the time, but he's going to, you know, teach and allow you to grow and give you tons of freedom offensively, and that's a special thing. I was going to talk about, we touched on it a little bit. You talked about the transition, you know, to the NBA from a basketball perspective, you know, with the schemes and I guess him having that, you know, NBA experience, naturally he incorporated a lot of stuff that was, you know, NBA like or whatever. Talk about what it means to you to be a leader on a team. What does leadership mean to you? Because that's such a loose term, you know, no one really knows how to define leadership, but what does that mean to you?
I think the thing that leadership means to me is, you know, don't talk about it, be about it. I think, you know, that's the biggest, you know, problem is that, you know, guys try to distinguish themselves as leaders, but they don't walk the walk. They just mm-hmm. talk the talk. So I feel it's one thing to, you know, talk about being a leader, but it's another to, you know, show that in your action. And I think if you want to be a leader, you need to prove that day in and day out with your actions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's where you got to start. You got to be a leader with your actions first, and then, you know, words can follow after that.
Right. I like that because not everyone is that, you know, in your face, rah-rah, almost, you know, Draymond Green type, you know, a guy who's going to, you know, yell at the, you know, get motivate team players and stuff like that. Not everyone has that in their personality. And I think what happens, you know, when this is primarily in college, because I can't speak from the NBA perspective, but some guys, you know, are forced into leadership roles. And if that's not your personality, then it's just weird. If you're yelling at people, you know, it's not genuine. And it's kind of awkward almost. Like, that's not really what that guy does. So I think leadership can, you know, manifest itself in tons of different ways. And Like you said, if you're not walking the walk, I don't think anyone will respect you as a leader at all, because how can you hold someone accountable if you're not,
Doing it yourself,
holding your end of the bargain. Like if you're just, for example, if you're consistently, not getting to help side on defense, how are you going to complain when someone else doesn't get to help side? How are you going to call him out if you're not holding up your end of the bargain? It just doesn't make sense. So I think, a big phrase is actions speak louder than words. Your actions as a leader carry more weight than just saying, oh, we got to do this, we got to do that. And
right.
It's huge. And I like to think about that, leadership in that sense, because one day whenever I'm done playing, professional basketball, the ball stops bouncing for everyone eventually, whether you're done in junior high or you're LeBron James, the ball stops bouncing eventually. And, I want to be a coach one day. Do you think coaching is something that would interest you one day, maybe? Or I'm not going to put you on the spot. I don't mean to put
for
you on
sure.
the spot.
I would love to be a coach.
Right. After a 15-year NBA career.
Yes,
hopefully,
exactly.
God willing. But, yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, exactly. I'd love to be a coach. That's something that definitely excites me. And, I'd be thrilled to be able to have the opportunity to coach.
Right. And I mean, I think as a coach, there's just so, I think guys who aspire to be coaches one day think the game a little bit differently. You're able to maybe step outside of yourself, not when a coach is yelling at you, it's not woe is me as much. Obviously, as you get emotional or if you get subbed out, you get emotional. But as you mature and time goes on, you understand, okay, why the hell did this guy just sub me out? Why am
right.
I, you start to think of things like that rather than just saying, oh, this is bullshit, this guy's messed up, I think if you're able to think the game from sort of a coach's perspective in that way, I think that can positively impact you. What do you think?
No, I mean, I completely agree with you on that, 100%.
Yeah, so let's say... Let's say one day you, let's say you are, just for to throw it out theoretically, one day you are, a college head coach. Ultimately, one day, what do you think you'll value, in a player or in a recruit, or what would be important things for you from that perspective?
I think if a player has the ability to work hard and loves the game, I think that's really all you need. Because if they're wanting to continue to get better and they love to get better, then you can mold them into something, that they want to be and something great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think those are the two things I want. And I want someone, that, understands the game and is smart.
Right.
I think the people undervalue smart basketball players. For ones that are just more athletic.
I know. I'm talking to the perfect guy regarding that. I feel like if you're 6'8 or 6'9 and can dunk, you get a certain level of attention and, accolades in AA, especially in the AAU culture, where there's no structure on the court. There's no defenses designed to protect the rim and prevent you from getting there. But, a guy like yourself who, wasn't a high flyer like that, wasn't, doing – between legs dunks or whatever, but could score with every hand and had every move in the book just about, was ended up being more effective. I think coaches tend to, if a guy can dunk, he can play, but there's so much more to it. And I think what you talked about is super important as a coach. You value a guy with a work ethic, because when you take a recruit, you look at him at age 16, 17, 18, you got to project what is he going to be in 2, 3, 4 years. That's what you're really looking at as a coach. And sometimes, it's hard to evaluate traits like work ethic and how is he coachable? Is he going to learn? Is he going to progress? And you can't really evaluate that. That's why recruiting is an inexact science, but it's super interesting for me to think about that. And I think something that's also important is a kid who's hungry, a kid who wants to, take this game somewhere, a kid who has aspirations, that's the type of kid who's going to get better and build your program. A kid who wants to, you want kids who want to be pros, as a coach, you want kids who want to be pros, and that's going to, build your program into the best thing that it can be. And I think that's what, from your experience, that's what Iowa State was built on, and what what made those kids hungry every single day to get better and better.
Right. No, I think you hit the nail on the head with that one.
Perfect, perfect. Yeah, so that is going to wrap up what we have for the main part of the podcast. And so the thing that I've started to develop and build is a top three at the end of every podcast I do. And you know, we're going, like I said, it's top three. So the theme of three, you know, I shot, like I said earlier, 257 3-pointers, 0 2-pointers. I'm a 3-point specialist. Theme of three today, very appropriate for George Niang, you know, a Iowa State legend, Big 12 legend. The top three places. What were your top three favorite places to play on the road? I'll go first with mine, and then I'll go to you, and we'll go back and forth for the top three. Okay.
Okay. Am I starting with three first?
Oh, did you do it in order?
Oh no, I can just randomly.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I'll start us off. I'll go. You know, yours is going to be different. Obviously, they're different, but yours is totally different because you played at one school, so you got to go to places multiple times and stuff like that. But my number one, or not necessarily in order, but one of my favorite places to play was when I was at Oakland University. You know, it's more of a regional rivalry between us and this team. It's not, you know, UNC or any other college rivalry that has all the fanfare, but it was always a super crazy, sold out, always, and just always a crazy game. And that was in the middle of the hood, actually, University of Detroit Mercy. You know, a lot of people might not know about it outside of the Horizon League, but that, you know, that game was always crazy, and the fans, we hated each other. Each team hated each other, and it's awesome to play in that environment when, you know, you're screaming at the crowd, and the crowd screaming at you, and you're scoring, and it just gets the juices flowing like crazy. Similar, honestly, similar to the Brewster Tilton games.
Super, some fun matchups, weren't
totally
they?
Special matchups. But that's my number one, University of Detroit Mercy.
Wow.
Who you got for me?
You know, obviously, I can say it proudly now because my old college team.
Perfect
beat them
timing.
Yesterday,
Perfect timing. But
I'd have to say KU for sure, just with how rowdy it gets. You know, like you said, you're jawing at their fans, they're jawing at you. Mm-hmm. You love the opportunity to be able to silence a crowd with a bucket.
That's the best, yeah.
So I'd have to say they're my number one for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that's just also, you know, historic venue, and so many great games have been played there in Fog Allen. My number two, I guess I said the way I worded it, you know, the top three was play on the road. But, you know, at St. John's, I had the opportunity to play in Madison Square Garden. So I guess I'm breaking that a little bit. Madison Square Garden, that's my number two. I mean, what can you say? You know, think about the, you know,
it's the Mecca.
It's the Mecca. Yeah, for real. And have you guys played there yet this season?
We have. Yeah. We have. It's a special place for sure.
Special, special. I mean, it's a lot of the, obviously it's an NBA arena, so it's an upgrade from, you know, just a regular college arena, but it was pretty damn cool to have that as our home court. You know, I've said on the podcast before, when we bring up the whole thing about, you know, choosing a certain school, you choose, you know, you get attracted because of the high level, the arena, the conference. So, you know, I kind of got a little mesmerized, a little hypnotized by the chance to play in Madison Square Garden. But what I will say is Madison Square Garden, it doesn't look so good from the bench.
yeah.
It's not so pretty from the bench. But it was a special experience to be able to play college there. And hopefully I get back there soon, you know, playing in the NBA and playing against the Knicks. It's a special place regardless. But who you got for number two?
You know, this is a rare one. You know, mm-hmm. I have played in Madison Square Garden, but both times, one, I was injured in college, and two, I received a DNP in the NBA. So, but, you know, my second one, I'd have to give some credit. I don't know whether it's because Iowa State was top ranked, but when I went to Texas A&M, mm-hmm. We played them in the Big 12 SEC Challenge. I thought it was pretty special there. It got pretty loud, and they do this dancing cheer. I don't know how to explain it, but I thought it was pretty funky. At one point, they were locking arms and rocking back and forth, and I thought the stadium was moving. So I have to give them credit. I thought that was a cool place to play at, even though I didn't play very well there. I gotta give it some love.
Right. Yeah, I can't. I don't have much to add to that, honestly, because I never played there. But I mean, it tends to seem that, you know, any conference with or any team with a, you know, a great football following and, you know, a great student section, student environment like that, it's just they're gonna have it rocking. Especially when you're, like you said, a top ranked team coming through with Iowa State coming to their gym. And this one, my next one is number one. It's a huge venue, but number two,
the Palace.
Oh, yeah, the Palace. Number one, it's a huge venue, but number two, the game there was just insane when we played Michigan State. You know, I hate to put a game that we lost on there, but I mean it was just you know, Oakland's never beaten Michigan State ever. They're 0-14 or 0-15 against Michigan State, and there's a lot. I hate to do coulda, shoulda, woulda, but we got pretty damn close. We had them on the ropes, and it was just a great college game. You know, just
did you guys beat them this year?
No, they lost to them this year.
Oh man!
So they still never beaten them, but we thought we had them. You know, we were one Kayfelder layup roll in away from beating them, but I mean that's beside the point. I mean, it was just a special game, special atmosphere. I mean, anytime I hit a shot, I couldn't. I felt like I was going deaf, you know. It was just so loud, and those are special time kinds of you know, games to play in and venues to play in. Who you got for your last one?
You know, I'm gonna have to go with you know, Hilton Coliseum. I've had so many great memories there. You know, I felt like it's always been home to me, and always have a special feeling when I'm out on that court. And I just love playing there. It's brought me so many memories, good times, and I love being there. Hilton Coliseum will always be home to me.
Easily a number three choice, but I could have easily said that one too. But I, you know, I got my ass kicked there, so I don't know if I wanted to you know, relive that. But I mean, you know, no disrespect to Oakland, but you know, it was the opening game of your, I believe, it was junior year. And
yeah,
Oakland's not, you know, not a huge name coming in, but I mean, these dudes, man, they had that thing rocking, and that was probably nothing compared to when you're playing a bit, you know, a huge opponent. But I mean, it was rolling from the get go. They're hassling the opposing team, you know, and I think your fans do some research too. They know the players and all sorts of things like that. I appreciate stuff like that, but it was. You know, obviously you guys destroyed us, so I'm not going to say it was anything that it was something that it wasn't, but it was a great experience to play there and at least get a small taste of my of that environment, because it's obviously a special place and holds a special place in your heart. But that wraps up the top three. Try to keep that going every time. You know, got to stay consistent with the threes. But really appreciate you joining me on here, just like I said, shooting the breeze. I really appreciate it, George, and wish you all the best and good luck the rest of the season, and hopefully we'll talk soon.
Thanks, man. Thanks, Max, for having me on here. I really enjoyed it, man.
All right, we'll talk soon. Take care, George.
All right, you take it easy, brother.